I just wanted to add, because, you know, we didn't talk enough about the Management Institute and how we teach, right, the methodology. Actually, I use a lot of the case study method. What we do, case study method. So what we do is we take cases which are, because we are teaching in a business institute, we take cases which involve the issues of ethics, right? And we use the case study method to evolve the principles. And that I say that from two points of view. One is, by using a case study, we allow it to be experiential, because the case study in fact simulates a real life business situation. So that's one advantage. The other thing that happens as the result of the case study is that the people get involved and they are then giving their opinions, and finally you can build the theory around that. But the other part of it is that if you consider, because I teach ethics and corporate social responsibility, now particularly with ethics, the issue that I have in teaching it, when I was originally asked to evolve a curriculum for business ethics, and I did that I think in 2002, and it's on that curriculum that we teach. The problem that I came up with was, when I looked at all the kinds of textbooks that exist in the world, and I've seen that elsewhere also, the fact that a lot of the ethicists are people who are originally, or even then, from a particular religious belief, and probably in this case from the Judeo-Christian tradition, right? Now, that in itself is not an issue. But the issue is, if you are teaching in a place called the Indian Institute of Management, you have to be very wary that you are not offending any kind of sentiment, and that you're providing an equal kind of facilitating platform to all. So the position I took was that instead of trying to develop something that is borrowing from one religious tradition or another, just allow the case study and allow children, or not children anymore, students to respond on the basis of their very different backgrounds, upbringing, their own religion, their own social backgrounds. We get students in these courses, typically we teach it in the fourth and the fifth term. We get some European students, because we have exchange program with 40 European universities, and some in the United States and Australia as well. Plus, we get a fair number, of course, Indian students, but who come from all over the country. And therefore, there are Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Jains, whatever. And then, of course, various social backgrounds, castes, what have you. But to allow the fact that, you know, allow the case study method to work means you're automatically making the students, A, involved, B, it's real life, C, they respond from their own beliefs, and then we discuss it. And it has worked very well. Otherwise, it would have taken us a long time to have a dialogue between this tradition and that tradition, and that couldn't have been the approach. So far, that has been working well in all the modules that we teach now, in the second year, in the two-year postgraduate, in the one-year executive MBA, in that visionary leadership for manufacturing, the IIT-IIM program, in the other, this long-duration programs. That's the methodology we have adopted. So it gives that experiential touch, plus it does this. Yes?
May I ask you an ethical question?
Ethical? Please. Tell me.
When you were describing your admission process.
Yes.
And the process of starting with 2000 and reducing to
700. Not 2000. I said, actually, it's 600 candidates,
yeah,
coming down to
600 candidates, two parents.
Yeah.
And eventually you end up with 70,
yes,
students. And along the way, you have eliminated, on the basis of certain psychological structures that you perceived and values and so on. It seems to me that what you end up with there is a very, very elitist kind of population. And I'm wondering, what are your ethical principles, based on Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that lead you to be able to justify them?
Very good question. Now, I'll tell you, the simple, without getting into too many complications, the simple response would be like this. You see, if I would ask any normal parent who wants to admit their children to the school, and I would, the normal response would be, why am I sending my child to your school? Because I want my child to do very well in his boards. Simply because, empirically, we've been sending children to the board exams from 1990. And in terms of average results, we are one of the best in the country. So there's a huge temptation of any parent to send their child or children to our school simply because they feel that if this has been the statistic for so many years, therefore, if my child gets admission, he or she will have that kind of a chance with the boards. Right? That is the most, when I first started, that seemed to be the most, the obvious, that was the response we were getting. The other thing was that, you see, basically, this is a school with a certain kind of belief and a certain kind of tradition. That means mother and Sri Aurobindo. So therefore, if somebody would come and ask, why is it that you celebrate Sri Aurobindo's birthday in this particular way? Why do you celebrate the mother's birthday in this particular way? Then at least I owe them an explanation to say that, listen, this is because this school has put its, you know, the whole thing is part of this institution, etc. Now, the third consideration is that our school, you know, the fact that the number is 70 is not out of choice. It is out of compulsion. Given the compound, given the facilities, given the infrastructure, we just cannot accommodate more. We were faced with a number of choices. What is the other option which other schools are resorting to? With many schools, what they do in Calcutta is they do a lottery. So you just put your name, somebody picks this thing, and if you are in that lottery, then you are considered. The other one is first come, first served. So the first few people, whoever come into the portals, get straightforward admission. It seemed to us that given that we had to explain two things, the fact that why, because we are not a school that's running because we are just passionate about education. We are into education at the end of the day because we believe in two people who were coincidentally educationists, who've given a philosophy of life and consequently a philosophy of education, and it's not the other way around. So it's important for us to explain that. If we took in that kind of a rabbit thing, and of course the other thing that I need to tell you is that we live in an extremely complex socio-political environment. We, in the end, have to endeavor, at least we basically have a lot of pressure exerted on us by ministers, bureaucrats, policemen, or the police forces, all kinds of arms of the judiciary, who try to basically muscle their way in. And it has even come to the point where at one stage, a few years ago, somebody wanted to gun me down because I wasn't giving the child admission. So I think that given all those considerations, what we do has seemed the only logical way of going about it. Sorry?
Is there a fee?
Of course there's a fee.
Can you tell what it is?
You mean the tuition fees? The tuition fees every month are about 1,000 rupees. It changes class to class. We also have an admission fee which is about now, we have an admission fee which is about 15,000 rupees one time. And we have a quarterly fee of about 2,000 rupees each quarter. But what we have as a policy is that while we make no, we don't have a very low fee for everybody, which we used to have earlier, as a matter of fact. What we've done is we've changed that to this policy, but wherever we find that a child's parents are having genuine difficulty in paying the fees, we take care of that situation. We don't really, you know, go tom-tomming about it, but we've taken care that no child has left the school because of inability to pay. So far it has worked. There's no formal system to take care of it, but so far we've been able to accommodate every single student whose parents, for one reason or the other, was not able to, you know, pay the school fees or buy school books or uniforms or what have you. So finance, we have said so far very proudly, without putting it in the prospectus, that finance is not the constraint to getting education here. Once you get admission, the only thing you're required to pay is your first fees. But after that, if somebody comes and says, listen, this is my problem, and genuine problem, and he's prepared to substantiate that, for instance, widows, very often, you know, we find with, you know, not enough means of income, we've made their children free or half free or whatever. There are many, many children like that in the school.
So there's one other financial question I would ask, and this is for two reasons. I have quite a lot of experience in admissions and fees and all of that from the USA, but I'm also looking at a possible future for Oroville, because if, you know, in the beginning, the mother used to send in students from Pondicherry to school here.
Yes.
And there's no reason why we couldn't have a high-quality boarding school in Oroville that is fee-based. It makes perfectly good sense to do that, but
yes,
no one has attempted it.
True.
So, do you find that that fee structure is adequate to run the school, or do you have other essential sources of
No, finance? For the school, that's it. You see, I must add here that when we're talking today more about the school, but the institution that runs there is called Sri Aurobindo Institute of Culture. Apart from education, we also do a lot of activities in the cultural field, including cultural concerts, art exhibitions. We have an art gallery, which is open to the public. We have a medical clinic with about 15 doctors taking care of poor people. We have a cultural education center. We have vocational training centers. But what we've tried to do is that we don't necessarily cross-subsidize. What I mean to say is that every unit is encouraged to fend for itself. By saying that, what I also say is that, for instance, if the medical section is not paying for itself, the way I internally justify that is because we get an income tax relief. So I say to whoever asks me that question that it's because of the activities of, you know, stuff like the medical center that we get that income tax relief. So that is, in fact, the notional contribution that the medical center is putting in.
And in the document that I read, you refer to this as sustainability in some sense, this ability of each unit to...
Yes, it's a bit more than that. It's a bit more than that. You see, as I mentioned earlier, my mother used to originally run this institute till 1999. It was, by and large, her handiwork. She spent a quarter century working there from 1976 to 99. Before that, mother had blessed and taken the property and all those things. I don't want to get into all those details. The financial model that was behind this till 1999 for the first 34 years was simply donations, or offerings as we call it, right? In the beginning, there were various people who gave those donations and offerings. Then it became a small group who were interested in that. But over a period of time, many of those people either died or came to Pondicherry or settled elsewhere. Till 1999, even my father and myself, we were, you know, working and plowing in whatever we could. When even I left my job and I, you know, asked a few people around and I said, well, do you think that you could support us in the same way? And I asked people who were really financially solvent and who had benefited from our institution. My concrete experience out of that is that the people who were... All the people I asked for benefited by the institution, and they acknowledged it, but the people who contributed the most were financially the worst off. Okay, so at the end of it, I found that, you know, there are certain compulsions in terms of payments. For instance, in a normal affiliated school, as you know, it's a mandatory requirement that teachers have to be paid as per government norms in that state. And we were paying much, much below. It's another matter that my mother was a very charismatic lady, and she had obtained the, you know, the permission, the provisional affiliation. But I realized that this was no passport to finally making the place run, and, you know, you can't... I saw that this was the only way, actually. Well, you see, I look at it this way, that whoever has a problem with money, if that person can be taken care of, I don't see why, personally, somebody who is floating in money should also be subsidized. And if you look at it, our parent base, or the people who come to this our institution, are not terribly affluent. The reason is very obvious, because we are located in the southern fringes of the city. It's on the outskirts. So the more the city has developed, it is developed on the center and on the east. So the people, you know, typically the Bengali population, they've sold off their property and they've moved to the southern fringes. Plus, there's a huge erstwhile refugee belt just next to us, which is, you know, people who came from erstwhile East Pakistan and Bangladesh and who resettled there. So financially, it's a very, very mixed crowd. In fact, I would say that there are more lower middle class to poor people than upper middle to rich. So it's a very mixed bag. But the point, very simply, is that for people who can afford, then I, you know, why should I make it cheap? And I feel that, you know, it's only right that they should pay the just amount, and people who can't, they should, you know, as long as their needs are taken care of, it's fine.
We call this a sliding scale in America, in private education. There's a sliding scale, and it's based upon the ability to pay. But still, there is a norm which is held out to be the optimal level. And this allows a wider spectrum of participation.
Okay, let's say, where does that leave us in terms of... How are we on time? How are we doing on time? Half an hour more? Okay. So that's a lot of time, actually. So I think we can probably start with a look at some of the other issues. There was a question raised, and I think the lady has left us, and I think the question was IITs and IIMs and what they are doing, and the frustration which her brother was finding in terms of mainstream management or technical education. I think I've partly responded to that question by saying that we are getting voluntary response from a lot of students, and of course we have ethics, values, social responsibility is part of at least the IIM curriculum. The other question that she had raised was the notion of time. How long will it take? I don't know whether... I think it's she who had raised it. You know, how long will it take for us...
Quality education, how much time we spend...
Is the pressure in the world? That was her question. I don't know of any...
was similar, where students were free to choose courses and teachers who were disciples and so on. But it was a one-on-one. Most of my classes were one-on-one with teachers, sometimes a very small group. And when you look at it in terms of normal feasibility, what organization can afford to have teachers on a one-on-one, or two-on-one, or five-on-one.
It's almost impossible, and that's what I said. We function on a 12-on-1, but even that is very, very difficult. Very difficult question to answer, actually. I don't know. I think that, and I've my own reflection on this in the context of Mother and Sri Aurobindo is that if one looks at what they wanted to attain and wanted to achieve, not just for themselves but for humanity in general, I mean, if one talks of it outside the context of, for instance, people like us who are gathered here for one reason or another, we've come to this this kind of an environment, I think people would say that it's pretty far-fetched, to put it lightly. That means transformation of humankind is from a practical standpoint, is a very, and if you talk about it time-wise, then you don't know whether it's tomorrow or whether it will take a few hundred years or a few thousand years. But the point I've always, when I think back, not necessarily about one book that Mother Sri Aurobindo have written or where they have spoken, but it seemed to me that while they wanted to accelerate the pace per se of transformation, they did not say, well, it will happen tomorrow. So, and if we say that, well, it might take a few hundred or a few thousand years, then I think that the question is answered somewhere. Yes, you wanted to say something.
Actually, I was thinking about my own background, my own system in Norway, and that system has gone through a huge change in the last 10, 15 years. Class levels are blended together, so to say, according to the students and people in the room. And what is also seen is that there is more time for mentoring individual children than before.
Yes. No, but you see, the answer is that that is also a relative truth. There is more time than was available before. But if you start from what is required ideally, and then you say, well, are we getting there? Then the answer is no. That will take a long time to happen. But I think it also has to do with a certain level of social evolution. It's not going to, we are all part of society. And education, the first definition is that, you know, it's a microcosm of society. So unless, I mean, social evolution and educational change will have to go hand in hand. There's no other way. So maybe part of the mentoring need in future, if you say, well, how would mentoring be taken care of ultimately? Perhaps part of social evolution would take care of the need of mentoring, perhaps. That could be one possibility. We don't know. Okay. The concept, now we come to the point you had raised, never-ending learning, how do we apply that in India and also in schools? I think that, you see, it's a way of approaching a subject or a way of approaching education. Very often what children learn in school, what we learnt in schools, many of those things we turned them on their head when we were in college. We learned that this was not the last truth. But at that point in time we learnt it because it was appropriate, quote unquote, for our level. What we try and do, and I think activity-based learning, experiential learning, life-based learning, allows us to mention that repeatedly to children, not only verbally, but allow them when they are exploring to build in the notion that this can be one truth, but this is not the only truth. And that the whole notion is that education is meant to be lifelong. All that we are doing is providing a certain base or foundation, but by no means are we building the structure. So somewhere, I don't say that we mention that in every lecture or mention that in every thing, but I think the notion that it's not an end in itself, that school and education will not stop there, that is built in. And we build that in consciously more with our teachers. because we...
In your system.
In our system, yes. That's how we do it. But I think that progressive schools also approach it in a similar manner, because, you see, the stand that is to be taken is that if you just simply look at technology, right? And that's a very easy way, because technology is a byword for many things that happen in society. One of the biggest things that we've unlearned a lot of things from technology, but one of the things we've learned from technology that the life of anything is very short. You have to be constantly updating and upgrading your knowledge base. That's true for information technology, biotechnology, in fact of all the domains that we now call knowledge. And, you know, part we describe as part of the knowledge revolution. So if we base ourselves on the knowledge revolution and work backwards, whether at school or at tertiary level, we can always tell the children that it is that. And I think in teacher education we can build in that kind of notion. It does not need to be a very philosophical notion. It's very obvious. And in India, there's so much of IT happening. All that you need to get is one IT guy who has to come and tell you how much he has to keep updating himself to keep his job and to keep doing his job properly. So I think that, and the element of change, which is so fundamental to lifelong learning, that I think children are experiencing and seeing their parents and society evolving, that with every decade or every year, the pace of change is only accelerating. Now, these are two fundamentals for lifelong learning, and I think it can be perhaps addressed that way.
Basically, what you say is that students see that the teacher is the researcher and not a teacher in pure sense. That he himself is learning, but then the more teaching also, he discovers.
Yes, actually there is this whole presentation by John Dewey, you know, talking of various educational styles, you know, and talking of teacher as the wise mother, the teacher as the navigator, you know, all those styles of education, and find the teacher as an artist, the teacher as an explorer. So all those notions are somewhere, you know, we are all, as teachers, a bit more of this and a bit less of that, and perhaps a bit more of this and less of that with one child and differently with another child. But I think that's built in. So this approach has to be first built into the teacher before it can percolate into the student. But at the tertiary level in management, education and so forth, even students appreciate this. I think there's a less of a problem understanding it as a concept, whether one can actually apply it is, of course, depends from individual to individual, right?
I'd like to add
please
a comment to that. I think if you look at traditional Indian society, especially I'm thinking of women, once they got married, their role was within the house and not much happening beyond that. They just got to be better cooks and they were good mothers and they were good daughters-in-law and whatever. But society has changed, and in the last 20, 30 years, women are now out working, and so in order to do that, they're better educated. And they're also, I've noticed, I'm not one of them out there, but I've noticed that there are more classes in different kinds of things that are,
yes.
Even physically, I mean, I notice a lot of people in my mother's generation, exercise was not their thing, but now gyms and things for women. And it's starting at a physical level, but pretty soon they'll say, well, if I want to get ahead, I need to learn another language, or I need to get better in English, or technology, or whatever. So modernization in India is two-pronged.
Yeah.
One is providing an advantage and an ability for people to pursue lifelong learning, and the other, the television impact is deadening everybody, oh, switch off the brain, and that's the end of the story. But that happens in the West as well. So there, in every part of the world, there is a segment of the population that will consciously pursue self-education. They are the evolving people, and the others just turn into packages.
Yeah. Okay.
Say something on that, because in Sweden, just when I was there now, there was an experiment which was done on TV and like that, no? And they had in a very backward school with a lot of foreign children coming, refugees, etc. So these schools are have very low degree of failure, no? Yes, low degree of success, yes. So they took in with the class, it was in after ninth grade, we move on to, that's where we have our shift over to the baccalaureate, no? And they took in expert educationists from Sweden in all the subjects into this class and took out their normal teachers. And it was an empowerment of the children, and it was a new way of learning for them. So actually, in the end, you have, of course, very big success. They have shifted big level, and you follow the children. You could see the resistance and etc. No? What was very interesting was, so this is kind of a, you know, happy outcome you have there. But what happened was, in the parallel class, the other ninth graders who didn't get this treatment, who was actually in the same situation, they got the teachers over there, so they got more teacher resource. That was one thing. But also you had the effect of the fact that something was happening in the other class, it was a challenge. They succeeded as well or even better. So this is, it shows actually, yes, that you don't need to have the yes, top thing. Also in the school where I was working, while I was in Sweden now, it was a Waldorf kindergarten. They have their teachers training over 7 years training. They are not considered to be kindergarten teachers until they're 7 years old. And they have every year a week when they go for further training. So there is a continuous thing like this. So this is very, these are factors which shows that actually you don't need to have just a top segment. The average teacher with the right stimulation, so actually exchange programs between schools is extremely important.
Yes.
Because each one has something to give, but they start to do less and less. Now. So these are actually, you can do it in the normal society. It doesn't take this, how do you say, quantum leaps. It just takes a different way of thinking often. No? I just want to contribute that.
There was one question I think you had asked, and let me see whether I understand it right. Let me first respond, and then you tell me whether you got the answer. What we do with our children and with the parents. You see, one of the big issues that we have at school level, and I'll take college level a little later, is that parents in India still force their children as to what they will, in the kind of specialization they would end up with, right? So at the end of school, or towards the end of school, when they are approaching, they have to make a decision, first of all, whether to go in for science or humanities or commerce. And one of the overwhelming facts is that most parents would tell their children, listen, at least in our part of the country, and it's not the same everywhere, but there is a preponderance of science. So therefore, everybody ought to be a science student. Somewhere else, I've noticed that the huge popularity of commerce and the liberal arts has suffered. Now, this is one thing that has been happening. I don't think it can be entirely addressed, but what we've done is, over the past 6 years, we've tied up with a very professional career studies institute, people who have the professional competence to advise on career choices. So they have, first of all, in their bag an entire knowledge base, or information base rather, of what are the various possibilities that are open, at which point in time, what are the entry level requirements, etc., and which are the universities, colleges offering that kind of education. The second, of course, is that they have a certain psychological measurements or, you know, other attributes they study. So basically it goes out this way, that they come, we invite them once a year. They come and they take, for that particular level, they ask all the children to sit a test, which is partly psychological and partly they also look at, you know, the academic component. And then they have, you know, first of all, it starts with the parents' orientation. Sorry, I forgot to say that. Starts with an orientation to parents, telling them that, listen, the world in which we grew up, the career choices that we had are no longer the career choices for today. They exist, but much more is added into the bag. Now, this is particularly true in India because there has been an explosion of career choices. When I grew up in school, it used to be, good careers used to be either engineering or medicine. Today there are at least 20 other streams that could vie to offer the same kind of opportunities that these two do. So one is that first of all we ask the parents to come and they make a presentation, you know, which starts with, listen, these are the kind of starting salaries after this, kind of requirements, kinds of possibilities, kinds of places where you could go to study. So at least they begin and they have an opportunity to interact, ask, whatever. So they get the idea that, listen, we know a lot, but what we know is not the entire universe. So when they go back and pressurize their children to do what they feel is right, there's a little bit of doubt that has been planted in their minds. Okay. Then it starts with the children, so they sit that little test, then they have one-to-one interviews, and finally they are given a set of choices that you could be this or this or this. And for so far, I have found that over the last 6 years, empirically, we've not exactly tabulated for everybody, but by and large for 88% of children, the choices that were recommended is what they've ended up with, and they're doing very well. All right, so it's a help, because I agree with you, at school level and even at the beginning of college level, children can be very confused with the number of options that are open to them. It also helps our teachers indirectly, because they sit in, you know, senior teachers who are teaching these children, they sit in and they begin to understand, oh my God, when we were young, this was not the case. Because remember, children also go and consult their teachers. Parents are one source, then they try to validate that with teachers. So when teachers also find, oh, this is happening, and every year, the more this goes on, the teachers realize, oh, then this must be the way to do it. So I don't pressurize and I don't say, this is it. And then a lot of it depends on what is the orientation or the particular aptitude of the child attitudinally, as well as what is the predisposition, etc. So it's a pretty, it works fairly well. I won't say it works with 100%, but with 88 to 89% of the children, we've found that it's a one-on-one on what was recommended is what they finally did, and most of them seem to be doing fairly well. No, we start this in class 9. Because in class 10, they're almost there, you know, their mindset is on the board.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, what, as you were describing it, traditionally, the family determines,
yes,
because of their own expertise and values.
Yes.
But we've gone beyond that stage of society.
Yes.
So now there's this idea that what will enable you to succeed in society,
yes,
is not what we did, but it's either science or commerce which is going to enable you to succeed. And as you said, the humanities suffer. And it's not based upon either the parents' knowledge or the students' capacities.
No.
It's just a completely artificial value system. You know? And one of the nice things about the NCERT new,
yes,
approach, the constructivist approach, is that they're saying that there should not be any specialization until after the 12th standard.
Yes.
Because students don't know how to select their...
Absolutely.
Track. And why should we limit them to learning opportunities before they're able to distinguish,
yes,
what they're interested in? Of course, the society isn't accepting that yet, but at least it's being advocated.
Yes.
Beyond that, in progressive education in the States, there is the idea that there are learning styles, and it's developmental psychology,
yes,
which is being used. And if that is understood early in a child's education, then their natural strengths in music or in kinetic activity or in rational thinking or in mathematics or whatever can be fed and cultivated, so that when students get ready to choose a career, they've developed their proclivity, their style,
yes,
their interests, and they haven't been reduced to some arbitrary level of values and learning.
Yes.
And so perhaps integral education can begin to look at not just the three levels developmentally, but also the complex streams
yes.
of learning abilities and interests.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're trying that in a very modest way, of course. It's beginning, but we also realize that there's no such thing, as you rightly put it, as science or humanities or commerce. In another context, remember we were talking about earlier how we, through those exhibitions and stuff and projects, we explore the interdisciplinary areas. So we find very, very different kinds of things coming up and learning abilities that we would find it hard to conventionally explain or understand. So that's coming up, and that's also another area where children get more aware of themselves, and you know, that continues. Yes. Well, please.
Come to your institution, coming to Orville.
No, but I think the point is a valid one nationally. I mean, even in India, it's a huge, huge problem because if you read up, I mean, since you're interested, you can get the Indian references from organizations like Tata Consultancy Services, Wipro. You know, these are people who are employing, and they are coming up with, you know, they've done surveys. And the surveys, the result of the surveys is that there's a new notion of employability. We talk of employment and unemployment, but there's this whole notion of employability. Is the workforce employable, right? And the employability figures are abysmally low, simply because what is coming out of the universities particularly, you know, they are, as you described, dinosaurs. Now, luckily, of course, I don't talk now of my little institute or even Oroville, which is much larger. We still are oasis. But if I take... oasis in the desert, yeah? But if you look at even this Indian Institute of Management, luckily, I mean, I'm only talking for direction. We get in people who've done postgraduate level. That means school over, college over, after postgraduate they come to IIMs. And it's absolutely job-oriented education, right? So one of the things that is built in there is placement, right? And at our level, we also teach so many, work with so many actual organizations employing people that even we are sensitized in terms of what we teach the students, right? That is happening at one level. I think to an extent even in the IITs it's happening, because even with IITs, a lot of industry is collaborating. You talk of this as the academic industry exchange. The more formal level chambers of commerce are collaborating with at least management and technical colleges. It's also happening in, to some extent, in vocational training. Because anyway, the demand for vocational training in India is so huge that by the time you pass out either as a boiler apprentice or something like that from one of these people, you get immediately absorbed. There's a crying need, very few people coming out of the ITIs. The big problem, even with chartered accountants and lawyers, I think the system is fairly easy with medical professionals. The problem lies with what you would call the straightforward, straight-jacketed disciplines, what we call the pure science and the pure humanities, supposing you did, you graduated with history, you majored in history, and the university has probably had very little exchange with who could employ you, for instance, the archaeological survey, or for that matter, the geological survey might or might not have had exchanges with the university. So my response to you is that at two levels, at a base level of vocational training and at a very high level of management and technical education, what you're looking for is happening, not maybe to the extent desired, but it is happening somewhat. It has also been facilitated, in India at least, by organizations like Wipro and Infosys, so forth, who have done what we could call backward integration. That means they are setting up schools or helping schools to develop that orientation. Schools and colleges, NIIT, they're doing that. And there's, a lot of stuff happening for them. But it's this middle bracket of pure sciences, pure commerce, pure humanities, where the mechanism is not yet perfected. Hopefully something will emerge. Yes.
And what you're speaking about, of course, is education that is skills-based to supply the needs of society.
Yes.
But I think our basic vision is more that we develop the capacities to the maximum.
Yes.
So that individuals have the flexibility and the adaptability to be able to fit in where they are needed and how
yes,
they are needed.
Absolutely.
And I think these things we have to find a way to
Well, it would only
stronger emphasis again, because this is getting forgotten. That used to be what a university was for, and that was to turn out somebody who was sufficiently cultured to be able to fit in wherever. So maybe this has to be.
This has to be also explored. Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's being emphasized from the top down that now we want students. Who are creative, who know
they are asking for all that.
Who know what it means to learn. And the NCERT syllabus is based on that idea. But the society is...
So again, it's a notion, a question of time, and perhaps it's people like in Oroville who would take the first steps, not only in Oroville, but I guess in communities like this elsewhere as well, who would take the first steps to making that ultimate bridge happen.
We've had a certain amount of experience here at the lower levels, where the parents were very concerned that all children were not developing basic skills. But then we have found that at a level where the children had choices to make, then they were actually able to learn whatever they chose to learn. And my nephew, who couldn't write properly at 9, is taking his PhD. Something so abstruse, none of us know even what it is that he's doing. And this has been quite an experience in the history of Oroville education, that it's worthwhile spending 10 or even 12 years allowing the brain and the basic capacities to develop freely, and that this is not wasted time.
No, not at all. The early notion, we all know that out here, that early notions were that you were described as a good or a bad student. But we've come a long way from that. We realize that every child learns in his or her own way, and we have to empower and enable the child to, pick up, because each child has a unique destiny. So those things are understood, and perhaps in an environment like here or a couple of other places, it's fostered. And perhaps the best thing is that what's not sufficiently understood, or perhaps better appreciated, that what is picked up early on, quite unconscious to other people, is the ability to learn. It's that which gets fostered. Yeah. So then when the real test comes of learning, then the child is already equipped. We had a very funny experience. It was one of our first years when we were experimenting with this kind of education, and still there were some lingering doubts. And at that stage, I remember that we do send our teachers a lot on workshops or all kinds of places where you can learn a lot. So basically investments both in-house, when we bring experts in or we send them. But on this particular occasion, there was this facilitation where it was a geography workshop again, but for class, the invitation went out to class 5 children, right? And various schools sent their class 5 children to that particular workshop. Apparently, the people who were organizing the workshop had probably forgotten. They were written it, you know, we normally in our part of the country write in Roman letters, class 5 is like this. And what they forgot to add was the two things. So it was actually class 7 children that the resource person was expecting. So with this huge gap, the workshop started and the first exercise was given. And the understanding was that these were class 7 children. And what happened was that most school children fared pretty badly, at least for the first half of that particular intervention. Except that some of our children were able to solve the issues she was talking about. Not that they had learned any more than other children coming from the other schools, but simply because the way of learning was that you know, the ability to learn and the ability to solve the problem-solving skills, the creative thinking, lateral thinking skills were a little more developed. So it's just that. So. Okay, so where are we on this? Education of art, sir. That was a point you raised. I think, let me talk of musical education, because that's easier, and I've had some experience of trying to work in it and around it. In India, although there is a developed university, college and university education in art and music, and particularly more, I'm talking more about music, however, it has not been able to overshadow the Guru Shishya tradition. Still very much the Guru Shishya tradition is what is emphasized. Because, very simply, the best music teachers are not necessarily university professors. All right? The university professors need to have a certain number of degrees, this, that, and the other, entrance requirements, the whole bureaucracy takes it in its stride that way. But in musical education, even as things stand today, if you do a Bachelor of Music, you probably will have less value in the musical world than if you have trained under a very renowned musician. Right? In Calcutta, one of our students, actually, from our school, she's now into TV serials. She's even sung songs for this new Hindi movie. It's no longer new, it's from last year. The Hindi movies get obsolete very quickly. The movie, you might have heard the name, is called Race, R-A-C. At least you might have seen some posters plastered on your wall somewhere. Sorry? Race was a very popular movie of last year, starring some of the most well-known actors and actresses of Hindi movies like Katrina Kaif and others. So she sang the playback, 3 or 4 songs. Monali actually trained under a musician called Ajay Chakravarti, who has a school called Shruti Nandan. It's very rigorous. It's much more rigorous than the systems that you have elsewhere. And that's why we also run a cultural school. And what we found is that in certain areas, we cannot bring in the university to... The university can be at best... That can solve a part of the issue. But the real issue is learning the music. So very much so, the Guru Shishya tradition is still very, very prominently featuring in music. However, in art and sculpture, the facilities, there's a lot of requirement of facilities, you know, so that, because of that, the colleges of art, at least some of them, are places where students would typically go to. And they get a better scale of preference when they finally, you know, turn out into the outside world and become accomplished artists. Then people ask, where have you learned art from? And if they can quote a good art school, then they stand a better chance. If you are a self-taught artist, your graph of struggle is a little longer. You still end up there, but it's a longer graph. But in music, it's very much the case that it's still very much, you know, the Guru Shishya Parampara that is holding the reins. And of course, we have another very unique thing that's happening, and I can tell you one example in Calcutta. I don't know whether you know about the ITC company, Indian Tobacco Company, an affiliate of British American Tobacco Bat. ITC has long diversified in India into hotels. They are those Welcome Group hotels, Sheraton earlier, Moria Sheraton, etc. Chola Sheraton in Madras, for instance. So they also have paper. They have now into, they are into agriculture, agro-processing. They are into almost every kind of business. ITC, about 20 years ago, set up a music academy in Calcutta. And it's sponsored and paid for by them, set up by them. And basically what they do is allow some of the well-known gurus to come, live on campus, stay there. And they don't have to really worry about a living. And the Guru Shishya Parampara continues there. In fact, there they come up with a magazine. And the magazine's name is also Parampara. Mm-hmm. So the Guru Shishya Parampara still holds very strongly with the Indian musical tradition.
But is there any teachment in the knowledge school?
Yes.
For this?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
I mean, at least to know something about.
Yes, yes, definitely.
This classical Indian music.
Yes.
Because what I feel, it is getting more and more sufficient.
So more and more?
More and more.
Suppressed.
No, superficial.
Superficial, yes.
Yeah. And it's more these songs and all these things.
You are right, sir. In fact.
And the real musicians which have this Parambara musicians, these people, they don't have, they have no public. There is. You know, they don't know how to live on their music.
No, that you are right.
They have life and there is nothing
yes.
left. They go, if they play a concert, there is nobody.
Let me say this. What you're saying is true, so let me take it from another end of the spectrum. Yes, in school education, there is music in the curriculum, but if you want to go deep into it, it's an elective subject, right? It's an elective, that means you take it out of choice. So very few people take it.
Yeah.
We had a seminar, again in the same place ITC had sponsored, where they got some of the best musicians of India, they invited some people who are into the educational world like myself, and they've just come up with the publication, How to Popularize Indian Musical Traditions Among School Education, right? It's, the publication has just come. So some of India's best-known musicians have gone on record there to suggest how the education system could incorporate that. So maybe you could take a look. In fact, I don't know whether I can get hold of a copy and send it back to you. If you're interested, that is something that for India would hold good. Let me say this, that it's a bit of a paradoxical situation now with artists and musicians in India. Some of them who've got a certain amount of name and fame, they are always attending sold-out concerts. You'll find them more in Europe and America than here in India.
Yeah. Yeah,
they are playing right from Wembley in England to wherever. So that's one kind of thing that's happening. Of course, there's another, which is folk music, and certain elements, certain parts, which are suffering very badly. There are elements of encouragement, but whether the educational system is fully understanding that at school level, I think that there's a lot to be done on that score. But even artists, like I can tell you, art. We have an art gallery on campus. We deal a lot with works of art, and I remember 10 years ago we used to have paintings more. It was between 2,000 and 20,000. Now they start at 20,000 and go up to 10 lakhs. Most of the paintings that we keep, and people buy it. So it is a changing world. It's not entirely a uniformly bad picture. So artists today are narrating, because I move around with them quite a bit, as to how they used to go around, not necessarily with a begging bowl, but they were very badly off, finding 2 square meals a day. And now, of course, they all drive around, many of them drive around in Mercedes cars and buying a new house in another city every other month, so times have changed.
Because we can hang something on the walls. Yes.
And some of that is also moving now through Sotheby's and Christie's, etc. In fact, when I go back this time, I have to meet somebody of Christie's to see whether to help them source some paintings. Anyway, it's a separate exercise. Yes, tell me.
Yeah, I would like to contribute another observation.
Please.
You are speaking more or less about a professional vocation in music and arts. But in Europe, especially in Germany, there are some pilot projects running, introducing music, especially music, a musical activity, but not necessarily an education in classical European music, into the classes as an everyday thing like sports and music.
Yeah.
And the result is that nearly 100% of all students have a better approach to learning in itself and a better approach in social situations where there were problems before, and it is like mounting up all learning abilities, introducing music.
Yes,
you
are absolutely right. You're absolutely, see, in our school we are doing it. Let me say this. You know that Howard Gardner has put music as an intelligence, art as, you know, an intelligence. So in the multiple intelligence theory, that's taken care of. Many of us use music and art for many areas, you know, to develop concentration as a therapeutic thing, to develop musical appreciation, art appreciation. In fact, because we have an art gallery, all our exhibitions, the gallery opens in the evening. But during the daytime, we bring our children to show them the works of art, show them, you know, they may not become artists, but to understand, you know, to understand and appreciate a work of art is very important. And what I noticed, and let me say this a little bit, at one point in time I used to live in Europe. And some of my friends, they were, you know, of this persuasion that when we would meet over the weekend, we would typically go to an art gallery. And we would see, you know, the works of art or the exhibition that was put up. And it struck me that in India we hardly have this. We would go to movies, we would go to the zoo, but we would rarely, rarely visit an art gallery. Or we would rarely, well, in musical concerts we do go to, but we rarely take the younger children along. We say, oh, they don't like it. We've, in our school, addressed this problem in two ways. One is we have a cultural club. I was at one stage telling you about clubs, Nature Club and the Interact Club I told you about. The third club is the cultural club. The last few years we've been running it more or less in collaboration with Spik McKay, which is an organization that works in developing, sensitizing children on cultural heritage, on India's cultural heritage. And they work right from school level up to university level, including at the IIMs they are working. And what they do is they facilitate the visit of artists to schools. That means, particular dancing styles that are disappearing. They would facilitate that troupe is paid for. They come at their expense, and they're visiting a particular city, then they'll go up to all the member schools and do a concert there for children to see and appreciate. We've gone a little further than that because we also have a cultural setup in-house. So we are no longer from this year working with Spik McKay, because we anyway hold these art workshops and music workshops. What I'm trying to say is that, in short, that it may not be part of the curriculum, but many professional schools and educational institutions are working with organizations like Spik McKay. And also, you see, there's also this thing between newspapers. I don't know whether you know that in India now we have a lot of, not exactly newspapers for children, but there are, you know, in Calcutta, for instance, there's the Telegraph, and there's a corresponding version for children called the Telegraph in Schools, TTIS. They also have a PACE program from Hindustan Times. They have a program from Times of India, Education Times, etc. And they, you know, they collect paintings, for instance, Voices from the Statesman, which they publish, or they have. We once ran 2 years ago an exhibition in collaboration with the Telegraph newspaper, where all the award winners from all over the state, their paintings were put up in our art gallery. So, you know, people are experimenting, A, with the therapeutic values, using art, using music as a tool. People are using, you know, are helping you know, in musical and artistic appreciation. They're using it as, you know, modes of multiple intelligence to develop and hone children's learning abilities. It's also being used to, you know, but, you know, the way to do it is not all the time enshrined in the fixed curriculum. You know, so therefore, schools which want to are doing more than others who are not necessarily on the same boat. So that's happening in India. So I think bits of what happens elsewhere in the world also happens here, but it doesn't always happen at the same pace and with everybody around. Okay, so what do we have? We are all running out of time. We have two more points, I think, two or three more points that I see that we still have to touch. One is place of the mental in future education. Well, I guess it's something that you would know more than I do. Let me start, first of all, by saying that. When we talk of future education, then we are talking of balancing the physical, the mental, the vital, the psychic, all these parts of, you know, education in the mother's own words. In terms of the way worldwide it's being approached, we're already talking about, you know, multiple intelligence is one part where some of these things are taken into account. You know, where existentialist intelligence, for instance, takes into account of questions of life after death and so forth. So it's recognized as a valid, you know, intelligence. The other part of it is that we're also looking at issues like EQ and SQ, emotional intelligence, emotional quotient, spiritual intelligence, spiritual quotient. A lot of academic conferences are happening around this topic. It is increasingly recognized as very intrinsic to basic education. But I think it's already a foregone conclusion that the mental is only a small part of the total map of education. However, as things stand today, the best of us are in transition. We are going from an education system that has been largely dominated by the mental, steered by the mental, if you will. Even what we are discussing today is still very much, the way we go about discussing is very much a mental activity. That's the way we have been trained. It's very cerebral. But as we pick up intuitively, as we pick up emotionally, as we pick up artistically, as we pick up spiritually and psychically, I guess this is all undergoing a gradual but an inevitable change. So, in Bangalore, Aurelio was mentioning this recent workshop that we're doing with Hindustan Aeronautics. One of the sessions that one of my colleagues does is, what is the role of intuition? Now, what I'm trying to say is, please appreciate that there we're talking of course I'm taking it out of context, but we're talking to executives 45, 50 years old, and we are asking them, please examine that there's a role for intuition in decision making. Now, therefore, what you do see is that if people at that level can come and even an organization like Hindustan Aeronautics, which has absolutely no connection with Mother Sri Aurobindo, and even the coach who's instructing is not necessarily somebody from this or related convictions, but they're reading up. You see, there's a lot of that's when you realize that the world is converging somewhere. Maybe not at the pace that we would wish or we would imagine or the way that we would like, but it's going somewhere. They're actually having a session examining the role of intuition in decision making. These same people are parents in schools. Their children are going to schools or colleges or universities. I don't think that 30 years ago, if even an IIM did a workshop somewhere, there would have been a session on the role of intuition and decision making and how do you develop your intuitive abilities. You know, so these are domains that are being explored, yes.
I said this last week when we were talking to another educational partner, someone else is visiting, but in our building, a school where I teach, they have done 10 years of research on program called Awareness Through Body.
Yes, yes.
Familiar with it.
Yes.
But that, I mean, one of the things they do
try to develop consciously is their intuition, their sixth sense, you know, the invisible or the worlds that are not obvious to the physical senses.
Yes.
But even otherwise, just for them to get aware inwardly and to develop their ability to master their emotions as well, because
yes.
I've seen them do exercises where they're asked to go wild, and kids love that, and for a while they're loud and screaming and whatnot, and then they're told, okay, wait it in. And there's suddenly pin drop silence, and they have to learn to master that impulse. So, I mean, if it's starting now, I think those kids will hold it and progress with it, and as adults we'll have some clue of how to master themselves.
You see, I'm reminded of that famous one-liner from Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, where he talks of forerunners of a divine multitude. So what you've done in Auroville over so many years, you already see that manifest in a completely disconnected area. I'm sure my colleague who's teaching that particular session has never visited Auroville. I'm almost pretty sure. He's not even familiar with the way you approach it. But from an almost disconnected work sphere, they're approaching it. That means they're delivering it. Why? Somewhere there is a demand for it that is growing. That is what, you see, and I'm not talking of now my school, but an IIM is basically catering to what is perceived to be a certain national demand. So it's a barometer to suggest that these are no longer isolated experiments that are happening in evolved communities like Auroville, but is being sought after in much more mainstream, rudimentary workplaces where the demands of people translate themselves into far simpler realities. Yeah.
You probably couldn't find in America today a school where some of the teachers had not attended a multiple intelligences workshop.
Yes.
Howard Gardner's influence has been
all pervasive, yeah.
Quite pervasive. And you can flip through any of his books and you can underline phrases from the mother in every chapter.
Without probably...
But he's never read the mother.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You see, this is something, we're now going probably a little bit beyond education, but this is something I've noticed, that it's not only education, but in every sphere of human activity, you find the words of Sri Aurobindo and the mother recurring with no obvious reference to their works. Whether the persons who are writing about it have read them, there is no way to tell. But it's almost true that when, you know, that little, you probably have all been familiar with it, a little discussion where a little child asks the mother, why do you describe Sri Aurobindo's birth as an eternal birth? And in answering that question, the mother has said, and in many, many other places, that it is almost like that the words that they've said have import that are being echoed in so many other people much after them. Contemporary people and people coming after them in so many contexts with no obvious reference to Mother and Sri Aurobindo, which gives people the feeling that in spite of this, you know, all that is crashing around us, perhaps we are moving to a much deeper reality, and that's where it all points to. I think, in India too, I mean, in these few sessions that we've conducted on educational excellence, I was telling you, almost everybody who attended have been familiar with Howard Gardner. But what I was referring to was a workshop. If you really saw those people, you would be surprised. People in their late 40s, early 50s, who are almost losing interest in their work life, who are just concentrating on making fighter jets or stuff so forth. So for them, intuition is not something that they can relate to, or that is a session they would ask for. So what I'm saying is that it is permeating across the boundaries of, you know, education and educationists into other territories as well. So that's perhaps what's interesting. I come now to your final question. The integral paradigm of learning, does it exist? I think the answer to that very simply is that none of what the mother said really existed in a tangible way. I first came to Auroville, I remember in 1960, before, just around 60, 1970. All that existed was barren land, the banyan tree, and the urn. And today you have this, tomorrow you'll have more. And, you know, it has grown. So if you, it has all been there on a psychological plane, and it's all getting translated into a material plane. You've seen that with your 40 years of experience here in Auroville. And it's going to happen. Integral paradigm of learning is there psychologically. It is being translated into all the dimensions that it ought to with every passing day and every passing month and year. I think except for one question, making a better brain and using the brain as a tool.
We've been into this for,
yes, so I think it's somewhat addressed.
Howard Gardner's work is interesting in this respect.
Yes.
Because he's a neuroscientist on the one hand.
Yes.
And he's a cognitive psychologist.
On the other.
On the other hand, and all of his research has been in arts, you know, arts.
Absolutely.
And learning, and with students. And so he can easily tell you about the neuropsychological correspondence.
Absolutely.
With all of his experiential content. But he doesn't dwell on that. What he dwells on is consciousness and its development and how to enhance it. But he's quite sure that these different learning styles correspond to brain centers and neurological development and all of those, you know, that scientific side is there behind. So the brain is being restructured, but not through an evolutionary process.
Actually, to support this view, I'm also just coming from the conference from Nimas.
Okay, Bangalore, yeah.
Bhagavad Gita is psychological science.
Yes.
Looking into that series, we want to know and understand what was proposed by Krishna, which is a great shift.
True.
Can you give us some reference of home pages where we can continue to see what work is going on?
Yes. First of all, you can take two. One is the www.sriaurobindoinstitute.org. That's our institution, and if you click the school educational activities, you'll get stuff there. And as far as the Management Center for Human Values is concerned, that's www.mchv.org. So these are the institute. Our full name is Sri Aurobindo Institute of Culture, of which the school, the Future Foundation School, is a part. So you have to go to the main institute website and click on educational activity. You'll see stuff there. And as far as the IIM is concerned, you can look up www.mchv.org.
May I add a comment or somehow came up?
Please.
How far intellectual development has to be included in a program of integral education.
Oh, yes, yes.
When the main aim is an inner development. And I think this morning you have given us a really remarkable demonstration of how the development of intelligence and the application of intelligence to a deeper aim, how helpful it is. And I feel that's a dimension we are missing a lot here. Maybe we have an inner direction and we have our guides, but perhaps there's not enough really intelligent reflection about how to do what we want to do. And if I can call it professionalism, that is showing that this can really serve the higher aim that we're all working for, and that this is a very, very useful part of the work. And whatever it is, now when we want to undertake this yoga of self-development, of this evolutionary yoga, the primary tool will be our intelligent will. So that's an essential part. Of course, there's something else that's supposed to give the guidance and the leadership. Intelligent will has to open to a higher light and a deeper thing. But it's the essential tool for us at our present evolutionary stage of development. So we shouldn't be ashamed.
No, on the contrary.
Of developing it.
No, on the contrary. You are forerunners, whether you like it or not. Well.
I'm sure you have given us very inspiring presentation of all that can be done and what you have done.
We just simply concentrated on this one piece of paper. Nothing preconceived of what would be done. It would be nice. Let's stay in touch. I think that's my own email is ranjan.mitter@sriaurobindoinstitute.org. ranjan.mitter@sriaurobindoinstitute.org.
And anybody who wants to join us for lunch after this.
No, I'd actually take your leave. I intend to. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I will go to Savitri Bhavan and then I'll make my way back. Maybe next time I'll, you know, stay back and spend more time than the whole day. Would be nice. No, it's not entirely true, but. Thank you, but
thank
you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. For me, it's been a privilege. You know, the first time I came to that conference, it's been the beginning of, you know, I've been in Auroville from coming since 1970. I remember, you know, when this Mahakali pillar was being built, I was doing a bit of the rod bending out there. So it's been a long association, but formally it's only since the last 2 or 3 years when I came for that one conference, and next I came when the Auroville Business Council asked me to come and speak on something. This is probably the third intervention. So it's really a privilege for me to, you know, to come and perhaps serve the mother and be a part of this illumination here. Thank you.
Thank you.